All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Eade, Judge Hallbrooks, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Good morning. You can sit. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, May 15th, 2024, and we have four cases on our calendar today, two of which are scheduled for oral argument. As noted, I'm Judge Sarah Wheelock, and I'm sitting with Judges Eade and Judge Hallbrooks this morning. And we are holding our arguments in courtroom 100 of the Minnesota Judicial Center. Our arguments are recorded by the court and should be available within about 24 hours on the Court of Appeals website. So with that, let's call the first case before us.
The first case this morning is A230848. Teresa Marie Nordahl, petitioner, respondent, versus Stephen Edward Nordahl, appellant.
And counsel, you probably are both well aware that you each will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes. The podium does move up and down, so feel free to adjust that. And there is a timer there as well for you to keep track. I would ask each of you to please introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument and identify your clients for the record for our recording. And that way we also know how to pronounce everyone's name. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, counsel, Attorney Jacob Burkholz representing appellant Stephen Nordahl. This case comes before the court on the appeal after a denial of a modification of spousal maintenance to the district court. Case was originally tried to the district court in Anoka in 2016, appealed in 2016, affirmed for $2,500 a month, two subsequent COLA adjustments, and now we're at about $2,900 a month. The basis for the modification request came against a wife, that would be Teresa Nordahl, for her increase in income. And I think what's nice in this case, unlike a lot of my cases, the facts don't seem to be generally in dispute. There's a couple minor things, but the facts being Teresa Nordahl has had a significant increase in income from about $16 an hour, $16.35 to $26 an hour at border states. And so first thing, approaching it from a matter of law, I think the standard here is de novo review. And the reason it's de novo review, some suggestion that it may have been an abuse of discretion, but it's the application of the law that matters. And the application of the law is whether or not, including recent Supreme Court decisions from Curtis v. Curtis, the Pooley case, and another case from the Supreme Court they cited in my brief, indicating the decisions of spousal maintenance, that'd be Dubris, Melius, and some other Court of Appeals cases. When we're reviewing the application of the law to spousal maintenance, it's de novo review. What is the de novo review issue I'm asking the court to decide? I'm asking for a bright line rule, because it doesn't really appear to be one, based on the statute, which says you can't award, you need to consider the need. And that's coming from the Curtis decision, 2015, Minnesota Supreme Court, and back to the 1980s to the Lyon decision in the Supreme Court. You can't award spousal maintenance over need. So the district court appears to suggest, which I think it's very lengthy and detailed opinion, but doesn't really spend much time deciding the modification standard. Focuses on the unreasonable and unfair and turns it into a fuzzy standard that doesn't even consider need. And so, and here's why that's a really...
The district court need to consider both?
Yes.
So, I mean, you need to persuade us that the district court erred both as to unfairness and unreasonableness and as to need, right?
I'm sure, yes. So I think the question becomes, does the court even really get there? I'm not sure it really spent much time on the unreasonable and unfairness. There are some findings regarding it. But the question the court seems to say is, I didn't meet my burden for whether modification is considered. Kind of a two-part. Do you present enough information to consider a modification? My answer is yes. In my reply brief, I suggest that it's a rebuttable presumption that if we can show that the obligee does not have need, and in this case, it's a clear answer is yes, that was proven. She's got between $1,100 and $1,300, depending on various factors, surplus by a finding of the district court and undisputed by respondent on appeal.
Don't we have to, under the statute, also consider the surplus against the backdrop of the standard of living established during the marriage?
Which is potentially, but again, my request is for a bright line rule.
Potential, that's under 518, 552, right?
So when you say as a backdrop, perhaps it's a choice of words. They had a very modest standard of living, and the court actually allowed an increase from their potentially from the or from the finding of inflation, right? So we didn't increase the standard of living. The court, district court, found that it was a very modest standard of living. And so what it would mean in this particular fact pattern, if the court says, well, I have to look at it as a backdrop, we're granting, what's the exact amount? Her budget was around 4,100, 4,132 maybe, and granted a surplus of $1,300, $5,500 a month over and above the standard of living. That would exceed any standard of living in the district court's finding. Very modest standard of living was found by the district court and affirmed by the second district court judge that replaced the trial court judge, O'Fallon. I think one of the errors, I think, is when we're looking at the overall analysis by, I think it was Judge Brown in the that decided this motion, was an exceptional deference, and this ties into my income argument, that it seems to suggest the district court, that the first trial court decision somehow has provided some interpretive deference, even though it's, I don't think it is. You have to look at the current facts. The current facts as they exist at the time of the modification. And so that's where it's being tied into things like, well, the overtime. There wasn't much overtime. Well, what is the backdrop? So if we are looking at the actual facts as to why maintenance was granted and the facts at the time of the trial court and what has changed for the modification and why there's been a substantial change, wife just became employed at Border States. I think she had been a church secretary making $12 or so dollars an hour and had a breast cancer diagnosis. Not a factor now. So if you're looking at the trial court's backdrop, a very modest standard of living, long-term marriage, and very limited income earning potential. That's gone from $12 to $16 an hour in 2016, and then that has progressed to $26 an hour, and bonus income over time. So where that kind of seeps in the district court, which I consider to be unnecessary deference that this court should not apply to the district court, is that deference says, well, the trial court didn't find overtime or didn't find bonus income. Well, that's true because Ms. Nordahl had never had a history of working. Now she has. And so why are we looking back at the original trial court order when there was no facts to suggest this history of bonus or non-bonus? Again, this ties into this confusing standard that the 20% rule and how family court and child support seems to interplay in support orders with alimony. I think it's a bit confusing as a matter of law whether that 20% rule would apply when the court looks at it in this case. So
I thought we pretty clearly said that we don't look at it in the inverse as you asked us to in your briefs.
Yes, I cite that in my reply brief, that there's no clear law that the way the statute is written, it's the decrease that applies, right, not the increase.
Which would imply that the legislature did not intend to have us look at it for the increase, right?
That particular 20% language, yes. It would, but the plain language says it's not automatic at 20%.
What's the bright line rule that you would ask us to adopt here?
No.
Is it that anytime there's a surplus, then there's no longer a need and that we should be granting the spousal maintenance modification motion?
Yes. I mean, essentially, it's not tied to the 20%. Because if you pick easy numbers, $4,000 budget, $3,000 income at the time, fast forward 10 years, you're now making $5,000 a month. Again, simple math, net income.
Doesn't that run in the face of those other considerations under the statute, like the standard of living established during the marriage? And doesn't that disregard, when you're just looking at those cold numbers, other issues like inflation and what was expected at the time of the initial decree to be the normal increase in cost of living and things like that? Like, why why should we just focus on the surplus? And then the last part of it is whether or not it's unfair and unreasonable.
Good question. I've anticipated this one, which is all of the facts that underlie the monthly expenses have every single one of those embedded in it. Every one of your concerns, Your Honor, of the circumstances that underlie all of the standard of living concerns, the history, the health concerns a party might have, right? Living expenses, all the concerns of the rest of the statute, financial circumstances, tie into the monthly expenses, in my view. And that comes up with the number. I mean, if you have a need, it shows up in the number. In what circumstance, I couldn't plausibly think of a circumstance where a party should be granted extra money with no factual basis. That's what's happened in this case. There's no factual basis to justify a cash payment in excess of need. Even Judge Brown couldn't identify it. Her reliance was it's just simply not unreasonable. What this court would essentially do is create what I'll call the Wild West of spousal maintenance and fan the flames, meaning you could have $2,000 a month. What would stop Judge Brown from granting $2,000 a month? Would she then rely on Mr. Nordahl's inability to pay? Because we're creeping up on that very hard, that number. And in the one unpublished case cited that I put in my reply brief, where it seems unpublished but seems to say, well, husband's making four times the amount of money, so therefore it's not unreasonable and unfair. Again, very different fact pattern, not binding on this court, but that's why certainly there's no case law that would suggest there should be an allowance over need. I could not find a case, nor do I think this court should make this case a case where $1,000 a month is no big deal.
But isn't that why this is a discretionary decision and it's being reviewed for an abuse of discretion? I mean, I don't understand what the legal error you've identified is that would require de novo review. And the second part is all of these considerations, at a certain point, it might be an abuse of discretion. If it was, you know, $100,000 surplus a month, obviously that would be a great concern, even if that wouldn't be something that the obligee couldn't afford. But it would seem to me that these are discretionary decisions and not legal decisions. Can you explain why I'm wrong?
I think the natural tendency to follow that line of logic would create zero certainty for litigants, meaning what facts would litigants be arguing? What the litigants are arguing in this case, and in every spousal maintenance case that I can see ever published or unpublished, is monthly expenses. I mean, after you get through net income, I'm going to assume for a minute we're not talking about net incomes, because we've done that a few times and get it reversed for net incomes. So again, assuming, Your Honor, we agree that there's net income and is there a need or not a need? Under that analysis, it wouldn't matter if there's a need. It would just matter if, well, I'm not going to abuse my discretion. So the litigants, the facts being presented to the trial court, as we argued here, relied heavily on monthly expenses. Numerous receipts, affidavits, extensive footnotes by the trial court. All of those factors are being applied within each of the monthly expenses. And the district court did that, and I think rightfully so. We're assessing what has changed from then until now, fixing the budget, including inflation, standard of living. All of those are in the footnotes, the standard of living. Every argument I think Your Honor's making fits into that. And go ahead, Your Honor.
That's okay. I have a couple of quick things because you're starting to run out of time. But following up on Judge Yee's question, can you direct us to any authority where the standard of review on a maintenance modification motion has been de novo?
That's a good question. I think most of them are all, as I'm thinking, right, the Hacker decision, Melius, Chamberlain, were probably all initial decisions. But I don't think we're actually applying the law in those decisions on the modification because I think we're in a unique factual circumstance. I don't think there's a case on point factually, and I can't cite to one, but I do think it's a de novo review as to whether or not need, in this case, triggers a legal review.
And, you know, asking this court to develop a bright-line rule is extending our role. As you know, Mr. Burkholz, we're an error-correcting court. So How is that an appropriate request to be making here as opposed to the legislature?
I'm not sure it is. Okay. I'm just telling you what I think.
Okay.
But respectfully, what is this court supposed to do? If we're not using a bright line rule, then aren't we applying the law? I mean, I think this court would say we're supposed to apply the law and try and determine the law and look at what the law is. I'm not necessarily saying this court needs to tell every court in a published decision that it is a bright line rule, because I do think that's probably properly before the Supreme Court. But I put it in my reply brief, is it a rebuttable presumption? I mean, if we're not even going to get past the argument that you can modify, even if you doubled your income, tripled your income as the obligee, wouldn't matter. We're going to have the tail wag the dog by arguing, well, it's abuse of discretion. It's not unreasonable and unfair. What factors do we use? If we can't argue monthly expenses, and if we can't argue need, which is a counterargument to your point, Your Honor, then what do we argue?
It seems to me that you would argue the standard that has been set forth, which is that there is, in fact, a substantial change in circumstances, and that rendered the previous award unreasonable and unfair. And we would look at the decisions that the district court made in that regard from an abuse of discretion. So why wouldn't we do that in this case?
You would. What's a substantial change? Income. Significant increase in income. That's a substantial change. That amount of income increases. That then looks at how it applies to your monthly expenses. Because it's in excess of need, it's unreasonable and unfair. So to me, it's that simple. If there isn't, those are all the facts the trial court looked at, in my view. It did a monthly expense analysis, looked at Mr. Nordahl's ability to pay, says he can pay. It's not my argument on appeal he can't pay, but then goes back to and says, does wife need this? And the court really said she didn't need it, but then simply said it's just not enough legally. So I see I'm out of time.
Yes, so you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
We will turn to counsel for respondent. Feel free to adjust the podium and remember to introduce yourself and your client. There are 15 minutes on the clock, so you may begin when you are settled and ready.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent the respondent and cross-appellant Teresa Nordahl. It's important to remember that this is a motion for modification of spousal maintenance, not an initial award for spousal maintenance. The standards are different, and importantly so. On an initial award of spousal maintenance, it is, of course, the recipient's burden to prove need. But now on a motion for modification, we start with the premise that she's already established need, and so it's the obligor, Stephen's, burden to show a substantial change of circumstances that renders the award unreasonable and unfair. Now, that's a high burden, and it's by design. We don't want people to constantly be relitigating their spousal maintenance awards every time there's some minor change. And so here, Stephen's main argument for changed circumstances is that Teresa's income has increased. But if you look at the amount of time that's passed since the initial award and the fact that the trial court anticipated her income would increase, the increase is really not significant. It's about 10% more than the trial court anticipated, or perhaps 16%, depending on how you do the math. That's not sufficient for a substantial change of circumstances. And even if it was a substantial change of circumstances, it doesn't render the award unreasonable or unfair. So here Stephen talks about the supposed surplus. You can run the numbers a couple different ways, but the important part is that what the trial court describes as her surplus is not the true number, because it acknowledges in its footnote that there's a number of costs that she does incur that it's not including in her budget, but is taking into account when it decides whether the surplus is unreasonable. And so some of those expenses are $523 a month in health insurance, $135 a month for medical costs not covered by insurance. She's a cancer survivor. She has a lot of those types of costs. And a couple of other issues on her mortgage and property taxes that we've laid out in our brief. You add all that together, her actual surplus is less than $500 a month.
But she's still getting a surplus. That's undisputed.
So, yes, but she also was getting a surplus in 2016 when this court affirmed the initial award of spousal maintenance. And so the numbers are important. It's about $500 a month plus the $118 she originally started with. And it's important because she's received a COLA increase of $461 a month since the initial award. And so this case really cannot be understood fully without the context of Stephen's attack on the COLA. And he admits in his affidavit that he does not think it's appropriate for the statute to allow COLA increases automatically without a showing of need. But that is, in fact, what the statute says. And so when you look at her surplus of $500 a month, almost all of that is COLA or surplus that existed at the time of the original maintenance award. And so to allow Stephen to make this modification motion sort of as an end run around the COLA, which does not depend on a showing of need, is really in conflict with the COLA statute.
Did the district court specifically make that finding or conclusion in justifying the surplus?
I don't think I mean, it's undisputed what the COLA numbers are and that there was a surplus at the original maintenance award. And so I think that's just undisputed. I don't know that the trial court articulated it the way that I'm articulating it, but nevertheless, this court could look at those factors to say, yes, this is reasonable, it's within the court's discretion.
Was this an argument presented to the trial court?
I don't know that it was articulated quite this way, but certainly we were looking at the fact that, you know, she had a surplus at the beginning. She's had COLA increases. She's entitled to COLA increases, and that's where we end up now. So I think it's wrapped up in the same types of arguments that were made.
And does that go to the it seems like one of the stronger cases in support of your position is Walker v. Walker, footnote 2, which seemed to me not to be dicta and to establish that when there's a standard of living that is tied to a surplus, then there's nothing unreasonable and unfair about allowing that surplus to persist. And then if we look at the district court's ultimate determination that this is not, the maintenance award is not unreasonable or unfair, it immediately follows its consideration of other relevant factors, including the standard of living during the marriage. So is the COLA argument you're making, is that related to the standard of living, and is that what justifies, in your view, the surplus?
I think it is, because the standard of living is part of what we looked at from the initial award. We said, yeah, there's $118 surplus, but that's okay. And then the COLA is, you know, just has accounted for standard of living of everybody, kind of goes up with inflation. And so it's all tied into that. I think it is, you're right, a part of the standard of living in the marriage, and it's not an abuse of discretion. And there is no bright line rule, as appellant argues there should be, that a certain amount in excess is an abuse of discretion. That's never been what this court has held.
Can I take you in a different direction and sure. Ask you about the employee stock program? Missing what the O is, stock
option.
Program. The thrust of what I read to be the district court's reason for excluding it from annual gross income is that it's not a liquid asset. And I'm having trouble reconciling that with the legal standard of gross income being any form of periodic payment, which is defined in the case law as repeated cycles are happening and appearing at regular intervals. Can you point me in the record or in the district court's order to where the ESOP was found to not be, and what evidence supports it not being a form of periodic payment? Because I don't, the not a liquid asset finding doesn't seem to answer that question, at least for me.
Well, I think it's no different than a 401k. I mean, an ESOP is governed by federal law. You can't take money out of it until you're 59 and a half.
Penalty. You can take money out of it. It's just that you'll have to pay high taxes on it, right?
Well, sure. But, I mean, the district court is within its discretion to say, okay, that doesn't make any sense. This is a retirement fund.
But we're not going to require. Retirement funds are included in the statute. They're not to be excluded under the language of the statute, right?
Well, it's not funds that she can access to meet her reasonable daily needs.
Without paying a tax penalty.
Significant tax penalties, yes.
But I mean, so here's why I'm having trouble with it is that 518.29A specifically says no deductions shall be allowed for contribution to pensions, 401k, IRA, or other retirement benefits. And deductions refers to deductions from gross income. So doesn't that mean that the legislature clearly wanted to include things like other retirement benefits like the ESOP in the calculation of gross income?
The difference here is that it's not her putting money into the ESOP. It's her employer putting money into the ESOP.
Right.
And so it's not from her gross income. It's not like she's contributing to a 401k. It's like her employer is contributing to a 401k. So it's not her gross income.
Is that established in the record that she does not individually contribute?
I believe it is.
Because I thought I saw in appellant's brief there was an allegation that she did.
I apologize. I don't have that specifically in my notes.
Is there something in the statute then that specifically distinguishes between employee versus employer contributions to retirement benefits or pensions or 401k? It seems to me it's more problematic for your position that it's coming solely from the employer, because there'd be a higher chance for double counting if she took her own income and then put it into a 401k versus the employer paying into it. Why wouldn't that be considered part of income?
I mean, all I can say is I'm not aware of any case law that has ever considered this type of a retirement plan to be income that she should have to pull out before she reaches retirement age. In fact, there's case law that says, you know, we don't consider that to be income when it's still building in for her retirement while she's still working. It's only income when you start to pull it out, which shouldn't occur until you've reached retirement age.
Do you cite that case law in your brief, Ms. Cool?
Yes. There's a case law, and it might have been in a footnote that they argued, because I think the analogy was to a pension, because you could pull it out, but the court says, no, you don't have to pull it out until you retire. Mm-hmm. And so that's the analogy would be the same here. Is this is a retirement fund. It's not liquid. It's not something you can access, and so it shouldn't be counted.
There seems to be a dearth of case law on these ESOPs.
That's correct. I mean, certainly they're not super common, but nevertheless, they are a retirement fund that's out there that's governed by federal law, and so they exist. And I think the court can take what's out there and how these operate and reach the conclusion of how they should be handled.
So your reading of the last line of 518.29A is that no deductions shall be allowed for contributions. That's if the employee elects to have part of their income transferred to the 401k or an ESOP.
Sure.
Then that's not excluded from gross income because the employee affirmatively chose that. But if the employer, when the employee signs up, says, as part of your compensation every month or part of one of your benefits, this isn't part of your income, but I'm going to direct this money to the ESOP on your behalf, that's not considered.
Correct.
That shouldn't be considered part of gross income.
And that makes sense, because what we don't want is for somebody to say, oh, I have no income because I've deferred it all to my 401k. But if it's not their income, it never has the ability to reach their pockets, then that's not the same thing. I do want to touch on, though, this idea that there should be a rebuttable presumption. That was not raised until the reply brief, and so the court should not consider that at all. We would object to that being raised, but it also would be incredibly problematic, because it goes back to this idea that he's trying to make an end run around the COLA statute, and if there was a rebuttable presumption that any award in excess of need, no matter how small, is grounds for modification, well, every time you have a COLA, somebody would bring a motion for modification. And that's clearly not what the COLA statute anticipates. It anticipates that these COLAs should be given as a matter of course without regard to need, because we don't want people to have to be continually relitigating every time inflation goes up. briefly, we also have a cross appeal on attorney's fees. The need-based fees, the trial court only considered one invoice, didn't consider the other invoices that she also had, so her attorney's fees have been significant, and she does not have the ability to pay. But especially, I want to emphasize that if this court makes any changes to spousal maintenance, that is going to significantly affect her ability to pay her attorney's fees. And so at the very least, if any changes are made to spousal maintenance, the issue of need-based attorney's fees should be remanded so that that can be considered with whatever her actual income ends up being if those changes are made. Conduct-based fees, also, I think here it would be appropriate. We have somebody who's admittedly brought a motion for modification in retaliation for a COLA increase. The court should make clear that that type of behavior is not appropriate, and conduct-based fees would be the way to do that. The trial court's own findings on his discovery conduct also support a motion for conduct-based fees, and so I think there's grounds for that as well.
Counsel, as to the needs-based attorney fees, is it correct that the district court did not find that the party, so your client, did not have the means to pay those fees?
The trial court said that the fees were incurred in good faith. Stephen has the ability to pay, and then it says Teresa also has the ability to pay. So what we're saying is that finding that Teresa also has the ability to pay is error. Because the trial court did not consider all of the attorney's fees that she submitted. And when you do consider all of them, she doesn't have that ability to pay. So for all of those reasons, unless there are further questions, we just ask that the court affirm the denial of the modification motion and reverse the denial of attorney's fees.
Thank you. Thank you. So we'll turn back to counsel for appellant. There will be 5 minutes for your rebuttal, and you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you. I want to just briefly touch on a couple of points I didn't get to on my time. There's bonus income. Again, factually, it didn't exist at the time of the decree, so the idea that it should have been was considered by the district court, and this was that mentioned earlier that there was some deference to that decision. There was no history of bonus income. Ms. Nordle had just started Border States. Now we have 7 years. I average every year. We're not trying to overreach, but regular, consistent payments is the law, and she did receive regular, consistent payments. The district court found she received regular, consistent payments. The only thing the district court found was that it just varied in the amount. So it got all the way through the right conclusions and the right findings. It just didn't make any application to Ms. Nordahl's income, and it should have. So we have bonus income that has been averaged, overtime income that has been averaged. This is all.
Isn't the standard regular dependable?
Yes.
And that's a little different than consistent, right? I mean, the dependable is the issue. There may have been some regularity, but my understanding of your counterpart's argument is that they're not dependable because one type of bonus is completely outside of her control, and at least the other bonus is dependent on profitability, which is also outside of her control, in addition to her performance. It's both company performance and her performance. So why should we consider these to be dependable sources of income?
Past performance is the only indication of future performance. Meaning if Target Corp's going to continue in existence or is it going to go bankrupt tomorrow, that argument would always be made and win. It can't. Meaning set 6 of 7 consistent years of profitability, income, bonus, and performance is dependable. And that's on an average. And so, again, if you have consistent across the board, we're not unfairly treating Ms. Nordahl in any way when you average it over 6 of 7 years actually received. This isn't three of five was one case law that found it was dependable. It was 3 of 5, and so 6 of 7. Other than 100%, I mean, I'm not sure there's ever a suggestion that a party's performance will be 100%. I don't know if I'm 100% every day, but we know that 6 of 7 is certainly consistent, reliable, and dependable, and the district court made those findings, and it should, just because the only exception the district court said is it varied on the amount. Well, not including any amount is error. That is bonus income, overtime income, and the ESOP. And I would agree, Your Honor, there's no distinction on the ESOP. This is a benefit. This is a periodic payment that is the issue that was on the trial court and to the Court of Appeals in Nordahl 1 was whether it was vested. There's no issue whether or not it's vested now. So the idea that it could have gone away entirely, I guess I can understand that. If you're not vested, why should we consider it? Because if Ms. Nordahl left border states, it goes to zero because that's the penalty in the handbook. Now that you're vested, we have 100% certainty that that ESOP is 100% available. And what is the unfortunate problematic part is now that $70,000 wasn't considered in 2016 or on appeal, and now all of that money is vested now.
Do we need to remand for additional findings of fact to identify whether or not the ESOP is, in fact, a regular, the payments in are regular and periodic, and therefore we should have that occur before a decision is made?
I think it has to be reversed and remanded for the income and the ESOP. I would agree. There's very little in the record on the ESOP. I've had discovery motions on the ESOP, and so we're left with, I think, Ryan Anderson, that's the trial court attorney for Ms. Nordahl, submitting some sort of a letter, and that's not even facts in my argument to this court.
Do you agree conceptually that there's a distinction between what funds are already in the ESOP as in that could be more considered an asset and versus the continuing periodic payments that go into it that may have some bearing on the district court's determination of need for other things in the budget, like $300 a month for retirement?
Yes. I mean, as a practical matter, it's just the court has to consider all financial resources, but the reason why it's unique in this case is because it wasn't vested at the original trial court in the appeal. And so I'm only making that point because if it were to have been considered an asset in the trial court or Nordahl 1, then we couldn't argue about any of that money because that's the Levy-Lee pension distinction. So that's the amount of money that's treated as an asset because you can treat present value calculations for assets like pensions or an ESOP, but that was not done in the trial court because it wasn't vested. And so Ms. Nordahl got the benefit of eliminating the ESOP entirely like an omitted asset. And now that it's vested, I bring that up to show that, again, as the full view of the spousal maintenance statute says, the full financial resources of a party, that adds to the error. Again, the periodic payment is the key, as I would agree with, Your Honor.
Well, thank you. Time is up, and thank you to both counsel for your briefing and for the argument here today. It's been very helpful. The case is submitted, and an opinion will be issued within the statutory time frame.